I'd like to very much thank the organizers for inviting me to this very interesting meeting, and I'd like to continue on the theme that was started earlier this morning on the idea that both repulsive and attractive cues may be involved in patterning the developing nervous system. But I'd like to move away from the growth cone, which we like to think of as a neural crest cell on a leash, and just talk about the development of neuronal precursors and how they move in the developing nervous system. First, let me give you a little bit of background into what the developing nervous system looks like at this stage. Most of what I'll be telling you about is in developing chick embryos. If I can figure out how this pointer works. The neural crest arises during the process of neurulation, shortly after the neural tube closes in the midline of the embryo. These cells then migrate out from the neural tube and migrate along very precise pathways to form a number of different derivatives. So for many years, people have studied how neural crest cells migrate and what they form. In fact, we know very much about neural crest derivatives from the pivotal quail chick chimeras done by Nicole Dorin. Now, the interesting thing about neural crest cell migration, particularly in the trunk level, is that the migration of neural crest cells is highly segmental, and I'll show you this in a minute. But what I wanted to point out here is that in addition to segmentation of neural crest migration, there's really overt segmentation in the mesoderm in the formation of these somites here. Somites derive from the unsegmented segmental plate, and in the chick, about every 90 minutes or so, another somite pair buds off from the segmental plate to form an epithelial ball of cells. And that's shown schematically here. So here's the neural tube, and here you have a nice epithelial somite. During the course of development, what happens to it, as you go to progressively more mature somites is that the cells of the somites themselves become migratory, such that the cells that are closest to the neural tube form a mesenchymal population called the sclerotome. Sclerotomal cells will then go on to form the vertebrae of the body. And then the remaining cells in the dorsal most part of the somite remain epithelial, and they form dermis and myotome, dermomyotomal cells. So the reason I mention this is because the migration of neural crest cells is intimately interlinked with the formation of the somites. Now let's look at what the embryo really looks like by taking a cross-section through the embryo here. Here's the neural tube. Neural crest cells migrate out from the neural tube shortly after it closes, and they undergo an epithelial to mesenchymal transition. And here you see these lovely migrating cells. This is an epithelial somite, and when neural crest cells first migrate out from the neural tube, they migrate into a cell-free space that's filled with extracellular matrix molecules. Now, because there are so many extracellular matrix molecules lining neural crest pathways, it's been assumed for many years that these molecules may be in some way guiding neural crest cells in an attractive manner. The neural crest cells in the trunk migrate along two primary pathways. As you can see, some of them migrate underneath the skin, and those will form pigment cells. Others migrate actually through the somites, and they will give rise to elements of the peripheral nervous system, including the sensory ganglia and sympathetic ganglia. So one of the problems we have with neural crest cells is, although they're easy to visualize in the early stages of migration, they subsequently dive into other tissues. And in order to follow their pathways of migration, it's been necessary to use a variety of cell marking techniques. And I'm just going to go over what the pathways of migration are of neural crest cells in the trunk region. And these summarize studies that have been done by a number of laboratories over many years. So there are several markers that have been used to study neural crest migration. I'm just going to show you one of them. This is an antibody called HNK1, and it happens to stain an epitope on migrating neural crest cells, and later on it stains many other cell types as well, so this is by no means a specific marker. Here's the neural tube of this embryo. Here's the notochord, which you've heard about from Nicole Dorin's talk last night. As I mentioned, neural crest cells come out from the dorsal portion of the neural tube, and they migrate, entering the sclerotomal portion of the somite. Now, these are quite invasive cells, and they migrate throughout the sclerotome with two very notable exceptions. One is that the region around the notochord is devoid of neural crest cells. And in studies that I won't tell you about today, but I'll just briefly mention, we've shown that the notochord actually produces an inhibitory substance, a chondroitin sulfate proteoglycan, that actively inhibits neural crest cells. And I wanted to mention this because for many years we had looked for molecules that were actively guiding neural crest cells, and one of the themes I'd like to develop today is that some of the things that guide where neural crest cells go are negative, repulsive influences, as you've heard about earlier today. So a second interesting thing about the pattern of neural crest cell migration is that their migration through the sclerotome is non-uniform, because if you cut some sections, you'll see quite avid migration. In other sections, the migration of neural crest cells is very limited. And this is much better seen if instead of cutting a cross-section, as shown here, you cut a longitudinal section down the length of the body axis. So in this case, the neural tube runs up and down the room, and each of these is one somite. And what you find is that neural crest cells migrate in a segmental fashion. They migrate through the anterior or rostral portion of each sclerotome, and they fail to migrate through the posterior or caudal portion of each sclerotome. So this is a lovely segmental pattern, and one wonders, how do you generate this exquisite segmentation? There are two other things I should mention. One is that this segmentation is very important for segmental development of the peripheral nervous system, because a single dorsal root ganglia and sympathetic ganglia form in a segmental pattern corresponding to this migratory pattern, and if you remove the somites, this pattern is destroyed. The second point is that neural crest cells migrate out from the dorsal portion of the neural tube along this segmental pathway, and subsequently motor axons, which send their processes through the ventral out the ventral neural tube and through the sclerotome, follow exactly the same types of pathways. So how do you generate this pattern? Well, one possibility is that perhaps there's intrinsic information in the neural tube, and these cells actually come out in lovely stripes. That requires a very smart neural tube. A simpler, and you can tell the explanation I prefer, is that perhaps there are actually differences between the halves of the somite, such that there might be attractive cues in the anterior half that give the cells a come-hither signal, or there might be inhibitory cues in the posterior half. And several years ago, Claudio Stern and I performed a simple experiment to test whether the information was in the somites of the neural tube, and that is we simply rotated the somites about the anterior-posterior axis such that this would then become anterior and this would become posterior. And what we found is that reversed the pattern of neural crest cell migration, so that the neural crest cells now migrated through the part of the somite that was originally anterior but was rotated in this embryo. So that suggests that there is some molecular information within the somites themselves that causes cells to migrate selectively. And that gives us a clue that if we're interested in this kind of patterning, perhaps what we should look for are molecules that are selectively distributed in either the rostral or the caudal portion of the somite. So over the last decade or so, there's been a great deal of interest in this question, and there have been many candidate molecules that have been found to be selectively distributed either on neural crest cells, in the rostral sclerotome, or in the caudal sclerotome. And I'd just like to mention a few of these. I'll be talking later today about the EPH receptors and their ligands. And the one thing I'd like to concentrate on first are the possible role of extracellular matrix molecules, because I mentioned to you that there has been a great deal of interest in what extracellular matrix molecules may be doing in terms of pattern of neural crest cell migration. In terms of their localization within the somite, the classic molecules like laminin and fibronectin are distributed fairly uniformly, but that doesn't rule out the possibility that they may be attractive or permissive molecules for neural crest cell migration. So we've tried a number of different approaches in order to look at the functional role of some of these molecules in neural crest migration. And this has been a rather difficult problem because we really wanted to look in vivo in the developing embryo. And we can use a variety of antibodies and add them to cells quite easily in tissue culture, but to get accessibility in the embryo has been difficult. And we've really been stymied in a way and unable to inject sufficient levels of antibody to get any kind of effects on trunk neural crest cell migration. Now, that could be because none of the molecules we've looked at are particularly important, but it's basically a negative result, and it's also possible that the system is limited in accessibility. So to get around this problem, let me just go on here. To get around this problem, Kathy Krall, a postdoctoral fellow in my lab, has developed an explant system which allows us to do two very important things. One is it allows us to visualize neural crest cell migration in intact tissue and actually to follow the trajectories of individual neural crest cells. And secondly, it allows access to of this embryonic tissue to perturbing reagents. So what Kathy did was she just realized that we could just dissect out the entire trunk region of an embryo and put it into an explant system and get normal development. And so what she does is she cuts out this tissue and puts it on top of a millicell filter, and then the filter sits on medium through which we can add perturbing reagents. In order to visualize neural crest cells, what we do is label the neural tube prior to explantation with a lipophilic dye, dye-I. And dye-I is basically a fluorescent lipid. When we put it into the lumen of the neural tube, it labels all neural tube cells, including premigratory neural crest cells. So the only cells that migrate out from the dorsal neural tube are neural crest cells, and these are therefore labeled with a dye. So let me just show you what these explants look like. This is a bright field view of an explant immediately after explantation. Here's the neural tube, and here you see the somites. We've injected dye-I into the neural tube, and the dye-I at this point remains constrained to the neural tube. But we can grow these explants for up to 48 hours and look at the progression of neural crest cell migration. And what we find is that we get very lovely neural crest cell migration out of these explants that follows the normal segmental pattern. So here's the neural tube of this embryo. Here you see that there are stripes of dye-I labeled cells that have migrated out from the neural tube. And if we look at higher magnification, as shown over here, what we find is these migrating neural crest cells migrate in a segmental pattern through the rostral, but not the caudal portion of the somite. So we've been able to recreate essentially neural crest migration in vivo using this explant system. Of course, it's necessary to know that these explants develop normally, and so we've used a number of molecular markers to try to look at to see if the patterns of both somite development and neural crest development were maintained. And what we found, of course, I wouldn't be telling you this if we didn't, is that these explants develop very normally. So this is an explant stained with the HNK1 antibody, which recognizes neural crest cells as well as the neural tube. So here's the neural tube, and you see this nice segmental pattern of neural crest cell migration. If we look at some markers that are present within the somites, this is a molecule called T-cadherin, which is an unusual cadherin in that it's GPI linked. And we were quite interested in this molecule because it's selectively expressed in only the caudal portion of the sclerotome. And as you can see, that in this explant, the expression pattern of T-cadherin is maintained only in the caudal portion of the sclerotome. And we've looked at a number of other markers, and we're quite pleased to say that these seem to develop very normally. Okay, so the real advantage of this system is that not only can we get relatively normal development, but we can actually visualize the migration of neural crest cells in this explant by time-lapse cinematography. And this is a bright field showing what the neural tube looks like and what the somite looks like. And then we look at our fluorescently labeled dye-I labeled cells, and we can follow them over the course of time. I'm not going to take you through the individual traces here, but we can from this derive a trajectory of how cells migrate. And so what's very interesting, we found a number of interesting things about cell migration through the somites. We can determine the rate of migration. We've determined that cells migrate in a relatively linear fashion. And interestingly, they seem to maintain very close neighbor-neighbor relationships. For example, here's a cell that has this green cell divided into the yellow and the blue cell. And these cells seem to come together and go apart, but remain relatively, sort of almost seem to dance with each other as they move through the somites. So we've seen a lot of things about normal neural crest migration that we didn't know before, but I don't really want to dwell on this. The main thing I wanted to point out is that this allows us to look at both the rates and the trajectories of neural crest cell migration through the somites. Okay, so there are two advantages of the system. One is that we can look at cells in real time, and secondly, and possibly more importantly, we have great access to perturbing reagents. So I'd like to take you through two sets of experiments where we've looked at the role of different molecules in neural crest cell migration using this system. As I mentioned before, we've thought for a long time that perhaps cell matrix interactions may be involved in neural crest migration. Neural crest cells have receptors called integrins, which are the primary extracellular matrix receptors on these cells. And integrins are heterodimeric molecules that consist of an alpha and a beta subunit. Neural crest cells have a single beta subunit, a beta 1, and this pairs with multiple different alpha subunits. And we've been able to use a blocking antibody to chick beta 1 integrin, which basically annihilates neural crest cell adhesion to a number of different extracellular matrix molecules, fibronectin, laminin, and so forth. So the first thing that we did with this explant system was to ask whether integrins play an important role in neural crest cell migration. And I think I'll need the lights down for this. This is an example of an explant viewed about 36 hours after initial plating. Here is the neural tube. We've looked now to see if there were any effects on the pattern of neural crest migration. And you can see dye-I labeled cells coming out from the neural tube in a segmental fashion through the rostral but not caudal portion of the somite. So we looked at this, and I must say we were incredibly disappointed because we saw basically no effect on the pattern of neural crest cell migration. So does this mean that integrins play no role in neural crest migration? Well, not to be perturbed, we went on to do time-lapse cinematography to see what the migration patterns of these cells looked like. And by we, these experiments were done by Kathy Kroll and Andres Collazo in Scott Fraser's lab. So when we looked at a more detailed level, what we found was there were actually some very interesting defects in neural crest cell migration. First of all, we saw fewer cells entering into the sclerotome in our treated versus control explants. And then when we looked at the trajectories of single cells, what we found is that they underwent two different types of behaviors. Many of the cells seem to have a very hard time migrating at all. So by interfering with binding of neural crest cells to the extracellular matrix, we seem to shift the balance of adhesions. And since cells couldn't bind to the matrix, they preferred to bind to each other, and they would remain close to the intrasomatic border. And occasionally, however, we found cells that could escape and seem to migrate, in fact, very rapidly. And what we think might be happening in this case is that when cells fail to find their proper substrate, rather than migrating at a constant rate, they actually almost glide through the sclerotome, migrating at just about double their normal rate. So by looking at detail and by performing time-lapse cinematography, we did in fact see some defects that were caused by removing interactions between neural crest cells and the extracellular matrix. And by shifting the balance of adhesions, we seemed to cause cells to cluster or to migrate very fast. And I wanted to show this because I think it shows both the importance and the utility of looking at real cells in real time, because by just casual observation of the effects of this antibody, we were unable to see these effects. Okay, then next, we wanted to know what types of integrins neural crest cells have on them. And Sung Keel in my lab has been doing a screen to look of neural crest libraries to clone different types of alpha subunits that neural crest cells may be expressing. And what we found is that neural crest cells seem to primarily express alpha-4 integrin, which pairs with beta-1. And this is the expression pattern, and we've done this in both chick and mouse. This is an example of the forebrain region of the mouse, and you see very nice staining of neural crest cells as well as in the branchial arches. The same thing is true in the trunk, and here I just wanted to point out these cells that are migrating along normal neural crest pathways. We can then use the same sort of explant system to analyze the role of alpha-4 integrin in neural crest cell migration. And what we find is that this is the control where we see nice migration in a segmental fashion. In this case, this is done in the hindbrain, but we see very similar results in the trunk. In the presence of the antibody, what we find is that the numbers of cells that migrate are restricted, and they seem to remain much more clustered toward the intrasomatic border. So what we've shown then is that neural crest cells seem to express primarily an alpha-4 integrin that pairs with beta-1. And although these integrins have no important effect on the patterning of neural crest cell migration, they may serve as interactions between integrins and extracellular matrix molecules are likely to serve as permissive cues that allow cells to migrate along their normal pathways. And in the absence of these cues, some of the cells can still migrate, but the rates of migration are impaired quite dramatically. Okay, so what we found then is that cell matrix interactions really don't have the kind of guidance role that we had initially thought they might have in neural crest cell migration, though they do have some more subtle effects. I'd like to then return to the problem of how you get this exquisite patterning of cells migrating through only the rostral and not the caudal portion of the somite. And so we were quite intrigued by the experiments you heard about earlier today, where EPH receptors and their ligands seem to mediate inhibitory interactions in the developing nervous system. And this seemed like a good place to look for possible inhibitory molecules that might be present in the somites. As you've seen from the earlier talks, these are very complicated, and there are two main families of EPH receptors that bind to different types of ligands. But this morning you heard about the GPI-anchored ligands, and I'd like to not talk about those today, but I would like to consider the transmembrane family of ligands, and these are called the EPH-B class of receptors, and they pair with EphrinB type ligands. Now, there are two important things I wanted to tell you about these receptor ligand interactions. One is that they're highly promiscuous. For example, any particular receptor can bind to any one of these three ligands. Conversely, any ligand can bind to any of these receptors. So we did an initial screen to see if any of these molecules might be present along neural crest pathways, and we actually took advantage of this promiscuity in the following way. I should mention that these experiments were done by Kathy Krall together with Rusty Lansford in Scott Fraser's lab. And basically what we did was we made a probe that consisted of the extracellular domain of a receptor coupled to the Fc portion of an antibody molecule. And this basically works as a reagent that can recognize this entire family of ligands. Conversely, we can take the extracellular domain of the ligand, couple it with an Fc portion of the antibody molecule, and this makes a probe which binds to the entire class of receptors. And so by taking advantage of this promiscuity, we can at least see if these molecules, these receptors, and their cognate ligands are expressed along neural crest pathways. So we were very excited to find that, of course, they were. And so this is the whole mount view of embryo stained with these reagents. And you can see if you look in the somites that you have a lovely striped pattern. Here we've used the ligand, FMB1, as a staining reagent to identify receptors. And when we section the somites in longitudinal plane, what we find is that the entire rostral portion of the sclerotome seems to express this class of receptors. So this is exciting to us because this is exactly where neural crest cells migrate. Conversely, if we look at the expression of the ligands, what we find is a reciprocal pattern. And again, if we look at a section through the somites, we find that there's very bright staining within the caudal portion of the sclerotome. This is the region from which neural crest cells are absent. So we have receptor in the rostral portion of the sclerotome where neural crest cells migrate, and ligand in the region from which neural crest cells are kept. And keep in mind that these receptor-ligand interactions mediate an inhibitory interaction, and neural crest cells fail to cross into this border region. Okay, so as I mentioned, these reagents are not specific at all, and we really wanted to know which particular EPH receptors and ligands were present on neural crest cells. So we went on to do in situ hybridizations with specific probes. And what we found in our screen was that EPHB3 seemed to be the receptor that was expressed on neural crest cells, and that's shown here. Here's the longitudinal section through the somite. Here you see the rostral portion of the somite through which neural crest cells migrate. We've stained the same section with HNK1 antibody, which recognizes migrating neural crest cells. And what we found is that every neural crest cell expressed this particular receptor. Interestingly, there are also many cells in the rostral portion of the somite that were not neural crest cells, and they also express this receptor. So this receptor is not just confined to neural crest cells, but also to rostral sclerotomal cells. And this raises an interesting possibility. If, in fact, these receptor-ligand interactions somehow cause neural crest cells to fail to migrate in this region of the somite, one asks if that effect is direct, mediated by neural crest cells interacting with this border region, or perhaps because some border forms between rostral and caudal sclerotomal cells. And I'll get back to that issue in just a second. So the main point then is that neural crest cells express EPHB3. We then went on to look at what ligands are expressed by neural crest cells, and what we found is that the ligand FRNB1 is expressed by the caudal sclerotome. We found that FRNB1 is expressed selectively in the caudal portion of the sclerotome. Interestingly, other members of the same subclass, although they interact with the same receptors, were expressed in very different patterns. For example, FRNB2 was expressed in endothelial cells only. So this seems to be the primary receptor that's present in the caudal portion of the sclerotome. Okay, so next we want to know if, in fact, these receptor-ligand interactions can act directly on neural crest cells. And a simple way to do that is to go to tissue culture. You can explant a neural tube onto a variety of substrates, and neural crest cells migrate out very nicely, generally forming a monolayer. And what we've done is taken advantage of the lovely culture system developed by Friedrich Bonhoeffer, and we created lanes of FRNB1 ligand versus a permissive substrate, fibronectin. And what you find is that neural crest cells, when they're exposed to these lanes of ligand versus fibronectin, will migrate selectively along the fibronectin lanes. And so what this experiment suggests is that this ligand is sufficient to inhibit neural crest cells, and it can do so directly. I mentioned that the ligand was also on rostral sclerotomal cells, but this shows that the ligand does directly inhibit neural crest cells. Okay, then what we really would like to know is if we can somehow manipulate the system, can we inhibit this inhibition, can we remove it? And so we added soluble ligand to this culture system. And what we found was that by the addition of exogenous ligand, we completely obliterated the selective migration of neural crest cells on fibronectin lanes. So even though efferent B1 was still present on lanes here, by surrounding the neural crest cells with exogenous ligand, we were able to competitively inhibit its effect. So this is interesting because it provides us with a reagent that we can then use to manipulate the system, because this soluble ligand can competitively inhibit the substrate-bound ligand as shown here. Now, the experiments I just showed you were done in tissue culture, and they do show that the ligand can inhibit neural crest migration, but that doesn't show that that's what's going on in the embryo. And in fact, there are many cases where you can give cells choices in vitro, and they may not necessarily obey exactly the same cues in vivo. So then we returned to the culture system that Kathy had developed in order to see if these receptor ligand interactions were important for the normal segmental patterning of trunk neural crest cell migration. So this is a typical explant that we've used as a control. Here is the neural tube. Here are single somites. These explants have been stained after about 36 hours with the HNK1 antibody to reveal the pattern of neural crest cell migration. And as I showed you previously, neural crest cells migrate selectively through the rostral but not the caudal portion of the somite in these explants. Now, what happens then if we add, as a competitive inhibitor, soluble ligand to these explants? Well, what happened, even in these static images, was very exciting, because we seemed to completely disrupt the segmental pattern of neural crest cell migration. So here you see a single somite, and neural crest cells not only migrate through the rostral portion of the somite, but they also migrate through the caudal portion of the somite. So by adding exogenous ligand, we did basically the same thing that we saw in vitro. We removed the inhibition of neural crest cells, allowing them to enter both the rostral and the caudal domains. In the previous experiments, the reagent I showed you that we used was efferent B1 coupled to the Fc portion of an antibody molecule. Now, I won't go into the details of this, but the way that EPH receptor ligand interactions work is that contact with the ligand causes phosphorylation of the receptor, which is thought to mediate signal transduction. When we started these experiments, we thought that efferent B1 coupled to Fc would cause no signal transduction. But when we measured the amounts of receptor phosphorylation, we found a very low but significant level of phosphorylation under these conditions. And so we went on to repeat this experiment with a form of the soluble reagent that was monomeric and caused no signal transduction. And so this panel shows what happens if you just competitively inhibit receptor ligand interactions, and the results are basically the same. We now see neural crest cells migrating uniformly through the somites. Okay, so we've done time-lapse movies of how what these cells look like in explants, and just because of the time, what I'm going to do is summarize the results that we see rather than show you individual cell trajectories. Under normal circumstances, as I showed you, neural crest cells migrate out from the neural tube selectively through the rostral portion of the somite, and their migration is really quite linear. When we expose neural crest cells to soluble dimeric ligand, what we find is quite interesting when we look at the level of time-lapse movies. As opposed to the linear migration of neural crest cells, we find that neural crest cells migrate in both the rostral and the caudal portions of the somite in a highly disoriented fashion. They undergo circular movements, and interestingly, they often migrate from the somite into the neural tube, which is something you never see under normal circumstances. So this is the type of ligand that causes a small but detectable amount of signal transduction. So what's interesting to note is that the cell movement is highly circular, whereas in the form of the ligand that's monomeric, if we do time-lapse cinematography, we find that cells in both the rostral and the caudal portion of the somite move in a linear fashion, similar to in control cultures. So what we believe is happening is that this type of ligand has really two effects. One is that it acts as a competitive inhibitor, as does the monomeric ligand, allowing cells to cross the border between the rostral and the caudal portion of the somite. A second effect is that this dimeric form of the ligand is functioning as a weak agonist. And that gives us some interesting information about how these receptor ligand interactions might be functioning normally. By causing some signal transduction to occur, these cells move in a highly circular fashion. And remember that this portion of the somite is basically flooded with exogenous efferin B1 ligand. And so what we think might be happening normally is when cells encounter this border between the rostral and caudal portion of the somite, this interaction gives the cells a turn signal that turns them away and causes them to selectively migrate only through the rostral portion of the somite. So this is one mechanism whereby cells could be kept from crossing this border here. Okay, so I'd just like to summarize the experiments I've told you about today. I think we have some very good evidence that EPH receptor ligand interactions function as inhibitory signals that prevent neural crest cells from migrating into the caudal portion of the sclerotome. And before I leave you with the impression that we've solved this entire system because we found one molecule that can be inhibitory, I think that would really be naive. And as you've seen earlier today in the retinotectal system, there may be multiple types of inhibitory interactions. And in fact, we have found, we and others, I should say, have found other molecules that seem to be involved in this process. In addition to inhibitory cues, there may be some attractive cues present in the rostral portion of the sclerotome. I've showed you that integrins seem to have some functions in neural crest migration because in their absence, neural crest cells migrate in abnormal ways. They tend to remain clustered at the intrasomatic border, and those cells that migrate very rapidly along these pathways. Now, these molecules probably have very little role in the guidance of neural crest cells, but it's interesting to pose the possibility that there may be permissive cues, and on top of that, perhaps there are actually molecules that cause neural crest cells to selectively enter this domain of the somite. And in fact, if you look to see where at the first neural crest cells to come into the somite, they always seem to enter in this domain. So I wouldn't rule out the possibility that these kind of molecules exist. But the exciting thing is that we're getting at the molecular basis of the interactions that cause neural crest cells to migrate in a segmental pattern through the trunk region. And this is very important for future segmentation of the peripheral nervous system. I'd just like to end by acknowledging the people who did this work. Most of the work on EPH receptors and their ligands was done by Kathy Krull, together with Rusty Lansford in Scott Fraser's lab. Andres Collazo helped with many of the time-lapse movies. Sung Kiel has been looking at integrins on neural crest cells. And we got many reagents from George Yancopoulos and Nicholas Gale. Thank you very much.